Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, some of you remember last week we were collecting your stories, your formulas, actually, for when you know you're really a New Yorker. And we've posted some of the best that came in from you on our webpage. It's there now. We got lots of great responses. So if you want to see your fellow listeners' formulas for when you know you're really a New Yorker, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, we think of success and failure as opposites. You're either succeeding or failing. But my next guest wants to question that binary. Failing is what you do on your way to success, says Sarah Lewis. Sarah Lewis is a critic at the Yale University School of Art in the MFA program, and she is also a curator. She has held positions at the Tate Modern and the Museum of Modern Art and has served on President Obama's Arts Policy Committee. She is now the author of The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure, and The Search for Mastery. Sarah Lewis, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
And you start this book with a surprising example for an art professor, archery. Hmm. What does archery show us about the relationship between failure and success?
Every archer has to handle what's called archer's paradox, this distance between where you think you might need to aim and where you actually do need to aim in order to account for all of the various sort of winds that might blow and things that might knock your arrow off course. This applies to life in general because those many variables affect the course of our lives as well. Archer's paradox is really how people achieve success. They're able to handle all the variables.
And there are many, many famous examples of failures and successes in this book. Tell us about the dance company leader, choreographer Paul Taylor, for example.
Oh, that's right. Paul Taylor is so celebrated today, it's hard to imagine that in his earliest dance, Seven New Dances in 1957, most people flooded out of the theater when they were watching it. But that contained the nuggets, the gems that he then used as the foundation to create his essential iconic style today.
And we know that there must be some tremendous stories of failures in our listenership, and I mean that in the kindest way, failures on the way to success. So listeners, whether you work in a creative field per se or whether you've been failing spectacularly in the sciences, which are also, of course, a creative field, or any other way, call in and tell us about it. Tell us about your best failures. Let's celebrate them now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What have you been trying to accomplish personally or professionally? What have you finally succeeded at? How did your failures pave the way? 212-433-WNYC, and we can certainly hear about those ongoing processes right now. If you have a question about what to do next or how to keep it going that Sarah Lewis may be able to inform, 212-433-WNYC. So your book's title is The Rise. What does that actually refer to?
The capacity of the human spirit to use this rubble, this sort of rocky foundation, as a way to ascend. I was also thinking about the arc of an archer's arrow's flight, and the way that it rises and then lowers a bit in order to hit its target.
And you tie this idea into the concept of zero. Mm. So what does the mathematical principle of zero have to do with our creative process?
Well, the gift of failure is a riddle. It is akin to the number zero, which is both the void and the start of this infinite possibility. And that's what many of our artists and entrepreneurs and innovators show us, that what seems to some could be failure is actually a bridge to get us to a new frontier.
And with the Oscars just last night, I want to ask you about another thing you write of in the book, the blacklist. Mm-hmm. And it's not the McCarthy era Hollywood blacklist, but it is a list of screenplays. Tell us more.
Yes. So Franklin Leonard innovated a way that Hollywood now uses to find some of its most lucrative, successful scripts. But these scripts are oftentimes formerly failed ones. Things like Slumdog Millionaire, Lars and the Real Girl, The King's Speech. Franklin Leonard was working as a Hollywood executive for Leonardo DiCaprio's company and wanted to find better screenplays. So he asked his colleagues to submit anonymously their answers to the question, what's the best screenplay that you've read this year that hasn't yet been produced? And when they submitted answers, he tallied them and sent it out anonymously. And people were surprised to see that scripts like Slumdog Millionaire, for example, that were being tossed around people's desks but not getting greenlit were actually the ones that executives thought had real merit. And then they got greenlit and went on to receive the many awards and accolades that they have.
So it's essentially a list of failures, but in being on this list, they become the most prized failures. Is that how to think about it?
That's right, because they have this imprimatur, the number of votes indicates that this is actually worth backing. The real breakthrough of the blacklist is that it got people to state what they thought about the excellence of the scripts without it being done through the prism of commerce, you know, what people thought would sell.
Right. Does the list also have a racial message being called the blacklist? I know you're challenging the idea of white being good, like the cowboy with the white hat is the good guy, the cowboy with the black hat is the bad guy, because screenplays are on this blacklist. And yet can turn out to be the most powerful. Is there any racial message here?
Well, Franklin Leonard is African-American. We actually went to Harvard together a year apart. He gave it that title. The racial element wasn't lost on him, but it wasn't the main reason. He did, though, want to play with the idea that what can be seen as on the margins one day can actually be mainstream the next.
Dana in Queens, you're on WNYC with Sarah Lewis, author of The Rise. Hi, Dana.
Hello. My husband, Elliot Lloyd, is having his first important, I guess, one-man show in many years downtown at the Y Gallery next week. And the thing is that he hasn't had a show like that in so long. I completely wrote him off as somebody who was doing work that seemed out in the wilderness. It was totally unaccepted. He did sculptures with beeswax and wire that nobody would buy for 10 years. And yet now he has had this, and his paintings are both the older ones and the newest ones are being celebrated totally out of left field for me. And I sort of said, well, I'll just have to subsidize him for, you know, his having taught at Parsons and, you know, being a wonderful instructor, and that's it. But now he's almost famous painter at 76.
How do you explain the change of fortunes?
There isn't any. He just persisted. Mm-hmm. He just kept being who he is. And although I couldn't see who he was or he is, through what he was doing, he was somehow aiming for this. Don't ask me how. I don't know. It's something unexpected, and it's a blessing, of course.
I love this story. You know, sometimes when an artist isn't achieving success, the failure isn't theirs. It's actually ours, our failure to see what they've done. Moby Dick, for example, when Herman Melville wrote it, it didn't receive acclaim for 70 years, right?
Well, nothing. I wouldn't hope to wait that long. But
no,
yeah.
Exactly. And so that's what I was about to say. It's thrill that you can celebrate your husband's accomplishments now.
Awesome story, Dana, and awesome that you can open yourself up to embrace it after it sounds like you were struggling with frustrations of your own in the support role. Mm-hmm. Tom in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. As an artist that's been earning my living this way for a few decades, I find failure sometimes is a way to expose false paths. And that you, by struggling against something, you not only learn, but then you can cross that off and focus more on what's essential in your artwork. Mm-hmm. And I was going to add, but your guest just addressed it, the failure of institutions, such as the Impressionists' problems they had, was largely the fault of what was accepted as art at that time. And I think we suffer from that to a large degree right now, in the auction houses and mm-hmm. galleries, in the global market.
I think I love this point. I think it's so important to see sometimes failure as feedback, information that we can use in order to improve, not a comment on our identity. You know, an example of this that we all benefit from now is that Samuel Morse spent 26 years trying to achieve his goal of being a renowned painter, and he saw his paintings as failed, couldn't support himself. He converted the stretcher bars of the canvas into the telegraph itself. So,
but Tom, I think your point also has a contradiction in it, because you're talking about learning from your failures as an artist, that they are the wrong path. But at the same time, blaming institutions for not recognizing quality because they have their own agendas, right?
Oh, yeah. I guess I separate working out the artwork and what I want to do versus what's going on in, and what's accepted by. There's two kinds of success in the work and then the outwardly success in society, like, you know, galleries and shows and sales. Mm-hmm. I see it as two different things.
Tom, thank you. Perhaps many of our listeners are thinking right now of that moment when we're on the verge of giving up. Mm-hmm. And you write about a visit to the Positive Psychology Center to explore the line between what you call dogged pursuit and dysfunctional persistence, mm-hmm. between knowing when to continue and when to quit, mm-hmm. as you put it. What's the Positive Psychology Center, and did you find that line?
I did. The Positive Psychology Center is an organization that's based at UPenn, University of Pennsylvania. Angela Duckworth has been pioneering a new way of research the importance of grit in our lives, in achievement, in education, in innovation. And she's found that grit is not simply pursuing a goal. It's being able to do so in the face of failure feedback and of great difficulty, but over time, over a long period of time. So this trait, they found, is a better predictor than IQ or talent alone for achievement in schools, and a better predictor in lots of areas of life. But the question is, when do you know that you need to give up on a pursuit, right? There's a dark side to grit, in another way of saying that. So Angela herself doesn't yet know. It's research that they're still doing. I went to her because I was curious about whether creativity and the arts might have an answer that is really invaluable. The process of making teaches us when to give up and when to pursue something. And it's one of the reasons why I think art is so important for education in general.
What do you mean the process of making mm-hmm. teaches us when to give up and when to persist?
Well, the example I gave about Samuel Morse might be instructive here. You know, for 26 years, he tried to paint, and then one day, because he was inventing all along alongside that, thought that that square frame actually could be better as a telegraph, you know. Now, the art is one of the few modes of living in which we are always the expert, right? The person making something is the expert. Only Samuel Morse could say the stretcher bars needed to be the telegraph. And I think having that agency, that sense of discernment, is really invaluable as we sort through where to move on our path.
Maya in Ditmas Park wants advice. Right, Maya?
Hi there. Well, it's very interesting to me that we're talking about grit as it's sort of coming up against, you know, the material reality of your situation. But my husband has started a micro school here in Brooklyn, and he's been very independent. He sort of treats it as a one-room schoolhouse, and it's been difficult because we're coming up against some serious material realities in terms of our ability to keep sort of bankrolling this school, you know, just sort of on our own. And it's hard to know whether or not we should keep it going for the next year. And the interesting thing about the school is that really what he's teaching the children is exactly that. It's sort of a failure positive school where the children are involved in tinkering and hands-on projects that encourage, you know, the experience of the process of making, just as your guest was talking about. And so it's you know, really a question for us because we're not sure if we can hang on long enough to reap the benefits of, you know, the investment of time and energy that has been put into it.
So is there anything that you're taking from this conversation or that you think Sarah could say to you to help you make that difficult decision?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's sort of the question that hasn't yet been answered is, you know, how do you know the difference between, you know, grit and what was it? Delusion?
Dysfunctional persistence.
Exactly, dysfunctional persistence. You know, and it's hard to know. We're very, very enthusiastic about this idea, and there's definitely seems to be a need in New York for affordable, alternative, non-traditional education. And
just from this phone call, my heart aches with the answer of yes,
exactly.
Continue.
Exactly.
You can't give this up.
That's what I feel.
That's what I want to say, too. But, you know, rent has to be paid every month. And also, you know, one of the major issues is finding an affordable space for the school to take place in Brooklyn and New York City in the market that we, you know, bemoan every day.
In the learn from failure model that I think Sarah Luce has been laying out here, is there any way for you to close up this shop if that's what you have to do to pay the rent, but then come back around with what you learned from it to do the same thing in another way?
Well, we have faith in that, but, you know, we do, you know, we're starting from scratch.
Yeah.
And it's hard to start from scratch every school year.
Yeah. You know, so many of us are dealing with this gap between where we are and where we want to go. And that's really the definition in my mind of so-called failure. But once we transform that gap and we bridge it, we call it something else. So I really do hope that we look back on this moment where you called in and we can see this experience as a learning experience, a trial that helped you either keep that school open or do it, as Brian said, and reopen it in a different way.
Maya, good luck, whatever happens.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's get one more caller in here before we run out of time. Kylie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Sarah Luce, author of The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure, and The Search for Mastery. Hi, Kylie.
Hello. So I recently started a nonprofit and have had this very interesting shift in my approach to failure, because regularly in life you think failure is bad. But when you're starting a nonprofit, particularly a social enterprise, there's a lot of funders and people who are interested in this who want to know, okay, where have you failed? Because they understand that that's the way to kind of move forward. And so I'm just so interested in this, my own shift in understanding now that failure is like not a bad end point, but a good starting point for moving forward.
This is so important, and it's great that you bring up this idea of how funders decide what constitutes success in an organization, because someone's ability to overcome failures is oftentimes their benchmark. So the more we shy away from it, the worse off we are in showing our leadership capacity.
Kylie, thanks. Before you go, you teach at Yale, but I mentioned in introducing you that you've also served on President Obama's Arts Policy Committee. What does that entail? Does President Obama have an arts policy?
He does. He does. And I think we all many of our callers would agree, we can never do enough to support the arts. And so he's doing his best.
So what have you done on that, just to give us an example of Sarah Luce in the political realm?
Well, much of the work revolves around the timing of the campaign and in order to make sure we've mobilized artists around the country to support the work that will happen in those next 4 years.
Well, we've posted an excerpt from the book on our webpage with permission of The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure, and The Search of Mastery by Sarah Luce, who is a critic at the Yale University School of Art in the MFA program and a curator who has held positions at the Tate Modern and the Museum of Modern Art and served on President Obama's Arts Policy Committee. Now, I want to tell you that if you want to see her and one of the people she talked about a lot in this conversation in a live event that will be later in the month, March 26th, at the main branch of the New York Public Library, 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, March 26th at 7 p.m. And she'll be there with playwright Anna Deavere Smith and Angela Lee Duckworth, the promoter of Grit from the Positive Psychology Center. There's a link on our website for more information for that. Sarah Luce, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's just an honor to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next for the morning after Oscar nights, after a few thoughts about some of the speeches, why New York is taking more and more Hollywood jobs away from Hollywood. Stay tuned.